Lecture 84, Reflections.
It's easy to assume that history is something that happened once and for all in the past. Actually, it's continuous, and we live with history's burdens as well as its benefits. The 84 lectures of this course have shown the immense vitality and diversity of American life, and that they've been underlain by certain recurrent themes. First, America's development has differed from that of most of the rest of the world, in its religiosity, in its national confidence and sense of destiny, and in the nation's incredible good fortune. Second, and closely related, America has enjoyed unprecedented wealth. An abundance of raw materials, plenty of entrepreneurial and inventive talent, and a gradual widening of the population that could share in the benefits of prosperity. By the millennium, it set the standard for the rest of the world to follow, and was a decisive leader of the world's economy. Third, its political and social system ensured that citizens enjoyed a wide range of freedoms, that its class system was fluid, and that democracy was as much a reality as an aspiration. And fourth, it was more successful than any other nation in bringing immigrants from every corner of the world and assimilating them into the American system. Compared to its high ideals, America always fell short. But compared to the other actual nations of the world, America was far more impressive for its successes than for its failings. Well, first of all, the question of American exceptionalism. American historians use the term a lot, and I believe that they're justified in doing so. Americans never lost the sense of being a chosen people. The idea originally of the chosen people can be traced back to the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, where God chooses Abraham and his descendants to be his special concern, the nation of Israel. That idea of chosenness was inherited by the Christians, who said that the Jews had surrendered it in failing to identify Jesus as their Messiah. At the time of the Protestant Reformation, the Protestant Church claimed that the Catholics had no longer deserved that mantle because of the corruptions of their church, and that the Protestants now held it. And in turn, the Puritans, who were rebellions within Protestant England, claimed that they were a chosen group of people and brought that idea with them to the New World, where it continued to affect the way in which they thought about what they were doing. Other groups have had the idea of being chosen peoples, at least at times. In the 19th century, the British Empire had the same view. But gradually, in the disillusioning atmosphere of the 20th century, as the British Empire dwindled and disappeared, that sense of being singled out for a special providence was lost by the British. In America, it still exists. The tragic side of this idea of chosenness can be seen in, for example, the death of the Native Americans. When the Europeans arrived and the Indians began to die off in huge numbers, we now know that the reason for that was because they had no immunity to the illnesses which the Europeans were bringing. But many of the Europeans interpreted it as a sign of God's favor, that God was getting rid of these older inhabitants in order to demonstrate that America was for these chosen people. Certainly, the idea of being specially favored shaped the idea of manifest destiny, which was the guiding philosophy of American expansionism across the continent in the early and mid-19th century. When we look at the exponents of manifest destiny, when we look at the lives of explorers and pioneers who went out into America, we have to be impressed by their dazzling self-confidence. The slow progress of settlement in the colonial era, such that by the Revolution, the European population of America was only about 100 miles deep from the Atlantic seaboard, was suddenly transformed by a galloping rate of transcontinental progress in the 19th century. And the absolute confidence that one way or another, everybody who stood in the way would go away. The Indians, the Spaniards, the British, even the Russians in the Pacific Northwest. None of them could withstand the spread of American civilization, and they should give way. It was divinely ordained that they should do so. Remorse for the displacement of the Plains Indians, for example, was very, very much the exception and was confined to a handful of people back east. And the Americans were very lucky as well, because they never encountered an enemy that could match them in energy or expansionist will or sheer power. In the 20th century, America remained exceptional in that, particularly in its foreign policy, it didn't pursue just realpolitik. It was always American foreign policy, although it was complicated, although it had a self-interested element, also had higher objectives in view. In neither of the world wars, for example, did the Americans make territorial claims. They could have done so, but they didn't. Instead, what they said they were doing was to attempt to extend the principles by which they lived throughout the world. Of course, there was a self-interested element to it. It created suitable conditions for the prosperity of American business and enterprise. But the United States could have gotten away with being far more ruthless, and certainly, had it followed the pattern of older colonial empires, it would have done so. Instead, it showed restraint and didn't follow the temptation to create a mighty empire of its own. Even the wars in Korea and Vietnam, although we might look back on them as misguided, nevertheless, they were largely selfless in intent. The Americans didn't want to conquer Vietnam. They merely wanted a non-communist South Vietnam to continue to exist. So the commitment to preserving freedom was a sincere one, even if sometimes it brought the nation into very difficult territory. America's been exceptional, too, in retaining far more religious energy than most of the rest of the Western powers. An influential theory in Europe throughout the 20th century was secularization theory, the idea that as a nation becomes more developed and as science pushes back more and more of the unknowns of the natural world, religion becomes less and less necessary because we no longer need supernatural explanations. Now we've got naturalistic ones. Well, if you look at Europe, secularization theory seems to make sense. But America's the great exception. Here, America, as it became more and more technically advanced and more scientifically advanced, nevertheless retained the religious adherence of most of its citizens. Second, a combination of cultural and environmental circumstances enabled America to become the richest nation in the history of the world. First of all, it was lucky. It was lucky in its access to immense quantities of natural resources. For three centuries, it was able to develop fertile land which hadn't previously been intensively farmed, and it was able to draw from that land very, very extensive timber supplies. Elementary things like firewood. Whoever thinks about firewood in the historical context? And yet it was very important. Europe was already overpopulated by the time of the first settlements, so that firewood was a scarce commodity. One of the things which delighted the early generations of settlers coming to America was that there's so much wood. Plenty to burn and plenty of them to use in building their houses. Later on, the next generation of resources was also available. Vast supplies of iron ore, for example, which was one of the foundational materials for the Industrial Revolution. The enormous iron ore deposits in the Mesabi Range west of the Great Lakes in Minnesota. Enormous supplies of coal in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and later on in Wyoming and Colorado. These were vital materials to get America's Industrial Revolution off the ground. Another extremely important commodity was crude oil for the development, first of all, of the kerosene lamp industry, which I mentioned in one of the earlier lectures, and then, of course, from the switch to a primarily horse-powered transport system to one primarily run by motor vehicles. The first oil discoveries took place in western Pennsylvania in 1859, which ended America's dependence on whale oil for lamp fuel, and later on oil discoveries in Texas, Oklahoma, California, and most recently in Alaska. Now, at the moment and throughout much of the later 20th century, America was wasteful of its oil resources. But if necessary, it could tighten up a lot in its use and become self-sufficient. That remains a realistic national goal. Periodic Middle Eastern crises have made self-sufficiency an attractive option, and it's at moments of greatest Middle East tension, like the 1970s, that America starts investing heavily in shale oil development, that is, getting more oil out of fields already being used. But then with a relaxation of the geopolitical tensions, there's a relaxation in the need to do so, and so America, at the beginning of the 21st century, continues to be a gas-guzzling nation on a massive scale. Even the secondary minerals were plentiful at American sites. Gold, for example, the California Gold Rush of 1849 is the one which is best remembered. America's first gold rush had been in Georgia back in 1829. the city of Denver was founded because of the Colorado Gold Rush in 1859. All over the American West, the first settlements were usually mining camps where the discovery of gold or copper or lead or mercury led to a sudden expansion of settlement as people went out to prospect for these precious metals. The economy of Montana and Arizona has been heavily dependent on the development of the copper industry. More recently, the economy of Utah has been built partly on the uranium mining, which became a vital commodity after the Second World War. So the raw materials were there, and that's not something we can take for granted. One of the great problems faced by industrializing nations like Japan is that they didn't have the resources and had to import them. But you don't only need the resources, you also need the right frame of mind to use them and the right economic system. And this is what American capitalism provided. It encouraged the rapid exploitation of these resources. Individual incentives offered to entrepreneurs proved much more effective at developing resources than any of the other available methods. America was the place where ordinary citizens, men with good ideas, could get rich. Now, of course, most of them didn't. The rags-to-riches tales, which are so central to American mythology, clearly only actually affected the minority. But the fact that certain people did do it provided inspiring examples for all the others. And certainly the economic techniques maximized the incentive to take risks and to try to find ways to continue to develop the economy. Certainly, if you look at the actual alternatives in the world, you have to be impressed by the productivity of American capitalism. The long alternative provided by the Soviet Union between 1917 and about 1990 showed that if you have a centralized economy in which the government attempts to manipulate every aspect of productivity and distribution, what you get is an enormous amount of bureaucracy, very, very low levels of economic growth, and constant shortages. Central to Soviet economic life was shortages of everything, and every Soviet citizen who's old enough remembers standing in line for all the commodities. By contrast, the flexibility of a capitalist economy, where an individual decides to take the risks of fulfilling a perceived need, has proved to be much more flexible and effective. And of course, both these systems, the capitalist and the Soviet one, were based on the assumption that economic growth is good, as opposed to the ancient traditional alternative of constant economic stability of traditionalist societies. The problem with traditional societies is that they're terribly vulnerable. And the way of confirming that is to look at the lives of the Native Americans. Many of them were hunters and gatherers when they first encountered the settlers from Europe. And one of the reasons that the settlers despised them was because, from the settlers' point of view, it seemed incredible that they should be living in the midst of such incredible abundance and yet not making proper use of it. Obviously, their entire cosmology was different. So it hadn't occurred to the Indians to become industrial entrepreneurs, but it certainly did occur to the settlers and their descendants, who therefore made much more effective economic use of the resources around them and at their disposal. Capitalism leads to reckless and delusional activity, and American history provides dozens of examples of the way in which people got totally carried away by unrealistic ideas, thinking they could do more with American resources than was in fact possible. For example, in the development of the Western Ranges in the 1880s, far too many entrepreneurial ranchmen brought their herds out onto the high plains. But then a very, very severe winter in 1885 to 86 and a drought killed off a huge percentage of these herds and demonstrated that there are actual natural boundaries which can't be transgressed in the attempt to make a fortune off the land. The history of American capitalism is also the history of the instability of capitalist markets. Recurrently, all through American history, there have been severe crashes where suddenly the values of stocks plummeted downwards in 1857, in 1873, a small stock market crash in 1893, and then much, much worse in 1929, again in 2001. In fact, the year 2001, in some respects, was reminiscent of 29, although let's hope that its long-term consequences won't be so severe. When long-term boom conditions set in, as they have done periodically through American history, periods of this sustained economic growth, it becomes ever so easy to forget that it's not something you can take for granted. And one by one, people who in ordinary times would have known, I ought not to get involved in these risky investments, I'm going to keep my money somewhere safe. If you're keeping your money safe and getting 2 or 3% per year return on it, and all around you, your neighbours are making 40 or 50%, it's ever so easy to get drawn in, isn't it? And that's what tends to lead to the overexpansion of values, which in turn are corrected by great crashes. So, American capitalism is certainly not an error-free or a risk-free system. But it does have great powers of recuperation. If you look at the aftermath of every one of America's economic slumps, you have to be struck by the fact that after receding, economic growth took off again and achieved far higher levels than ever previously. Now, capitalism in America has also assured massive inequality of incomes. Equality, as it's been interpreted in American tradition, has not meant equality of outcomes. It's meant equality of opportunities. Everybody's got the chance to try to make a fortune, but of course, some people are going to be much better at it than others. And throughout American history, we've witnessed vast disparities between the wealthiest and the poorest. If you're not a risk taker, the temptation is to settle for a job in which you can earn a reliable wage over a long period of time. If you are a risk taker, you can attempt to get involved as an entrepreneur with the possibility of making a fortune, but also the possibility of bankruptcy constantly staring you in the face. Even so, we have to be struck by the fact that the entire American population was being collectively enriched, particularly in the later 20th century, so that people who were dependent upon wages, and even more those dependent on salaries in white-collar professions, were earning greater and greater incomes as family income kept rising and as the distribution of wealth throughout America spread more widely. So that by the millennium, there was a very highly educated workforce, men and women, most of whom could anticipate high standards of living. In previous lectures, I've mentioned American poverty, which is obviously a continuing serious problem. It's important to realize that poverty itself is a relative matter, and that what looks like poverty in America and is defined as poverty in America would not be defined as poverty in most of the rest of the world. Certainly in third world terms, even the American poor are well-to-do. For example, being overweight is commonly a problem of the American poor, whereas in most societies, certainly throughout most of the history of the world, to be overweight was a sign of prosperity. That's itself a reminder of the relative measures that we have to bring to bear here. Poverty in a third world country means vastly greater privation than poverty in the United States. Well, the third main theme, this is that America's political institutions nurtured and protected vital freedoms. First of all, the American Constitution itself, written in extremely difficult circumstances, when the early Republic seemed in jeopardy of collapsing altogether because of the inadequacy of the Articles of Confederation. It proved itself to be effective for the next two centuries. Put into practice at the end of the 1780s, it was still working fine by the end of the 1980s and into the 21st century. And of course, the political stability which it created and the political freedom which citizens enjoyed within it combined to nurture prosperity. It's much more likely that you're going to have economic growth and that people are going to have the confidence to undertake bold economic initiatives if they're certain that there's going to be internal civil peace. We're so familiar with it that it's easy to forget how rare it is. There aren't many nations in the world which have gone for more than 200 years continuously under the guidance of one constitutional system. Switzerland and Britain are the only examples which come quickly to mind. One of the measures of the success of the American system is this, that in elections, the side which has lost, the party which has lost, admits that it's lost. Because they know that sooner or later there's going to be another election, and that the people who won this election will honour the fact that there should be another election and that their time will come around again. That's one of the things which makes it so hard to establish democracies around the world, especially in places which have no tradition of it. Because routinely in fledgling democracies, either the winning side, having won, then abolishes the system so that it can stay in power, or the losing side refuses to acknowledge the legitimacy of its loss and declares war against the winner. That's a classic scene in dozens of third world countries attempting unsuccessfully to make the transition to democracy. Equally important is the idea that the armed forces take seriously the fact that they must not become directly involved in political life. They've got to stay out of it. If you think of the history of Latin America in the 20th century, again and again and again, you find that civil governments are overthrown by generals, strongmen, who become dictators, because they've got a monopoly of force. By contrast, even America's most politically domineering generals, people like General MacArthur, although MacArthur lost his job because of his unwise political remarks in the Korean War, he never made any attempt to launch a coup. Far more common in American history is the honored war hero who then retires from military life, after which is invited to become a participant in the civil political system. The general who becomes president, people like Washington and Andrew Jackson and Eisenhower in the 1950s. Losers admitting that they've lost is vital, but we're so used to it we forget how rare and how precious that is. American democracy has widened steadily since the 1780s and has made the political system responsive to the citizens' interests. Most white men in America had gained the vote before 1860. There were all kinds of variations in the different state constitutions, but by and large, if you were a white man, you could vote by 1860, even if you didn't have any property. Women participated in American elections from about 1920 onwards. In a few states, they'd already got the right to vote, and nationwide, women could vote from 1920 onwards. African Americans had been guaranteed the right to vote by the post-Civil War amendments, but then Redeemer governments in the South had prevented them from actually exercising that right, so that it wasn't until the Civil Rights Movement of the 1950s and 60s that full participation of the African American population in elections came about. But nevertheless, if you look at American history as a whole, you have to be struck by the way in which there's been a steady augmentation of the number of people voting. The Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, and the operation of the Supreme Court prevent democracy from degenerating into demagogy, which is another of the hazards to which a democracy is prey. There have been demagogues, people like Huey Long and Senator Joe McCarthy, but the system has contained the amount of damage they could do. Efforts to produce sudden, dramatic change in America have nearly always been restrained by the Supreme Court. So that, for example, some of the dramatic changes in the early days of the New Deal were ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court because they violated constitutional principles which can't simply be dislodged by an act of Congress. Of course, the Supreme Court has not been immune to changes in the social setting in which it's working. For example, the Brown case, the case which inaugurated the desegregation of public schools, was clearly a response to new ideas about what was and was not socially acceptable as a racial policy. The Brown case overturned dozens of precedents, including the Plessy versus Ferguson case, which had upheld separate but equal facilities. But the Supreme Court also tends to move at a very deliberate pace, sometimes too slowly for impatient people, but nevertheless contributing to political stability, which is such a value of the system. And again, as with all these things, it's not a perfect system, and it falls very far short of the ideal. But compared to the actual available alternatives in the world, there's a great deal to praise about it as well. New generations of citizens grow up learning to take the principles of democracy very seriously, the principles of democracy and equality. Young Americans are actually educated to be citizens of the system. I can just digress here to say that growing up in Britain, I never had any kind of citizenship education. Nobody ever told me that Britain was a democracy, and certainly nobody ever told me that I was just as good as anybody else. The emphatic attachment to equality is something very rare in America, which most other societies don't have. I mean, Britain is a democracy, but there's no veneration of the principle itself. And a contrast I've always been very, very aware of as a British newcomer to America is that there are far more fluid social classes in America than there are in most of the rest of the world. Social class clearly exists, but it's much easier to move from one class to the next in America than it is in most of the rest of the world. There's lots of upward and downward social mobility in the United States. Now, although certain groups obviously fare far less well than others, in particular, the Native Americans and the African Americans have found life in America particularly trying. Every disadvantaged group tends to become the focus of philanthropy and to become the focus of particular attentive policies from the government. Americans' giving to charities is immense. They're the most philanthropic people in the world. Well, now, fourth, America's welcomed and assimilated more varied immigrant groups than any other nation in the world's history. And it's ever so easy again to forget what a great achievement that is. The world is full of harsh ethnic rivalries that sometimes become genocidal. You've only got to look at Bosnia in the 1990s to see that. Even America's northern neighbour, Canada, has been far less successful in its assimilation policies than the United States, so that the French-speaking Quebec population is still unassimilated 250 years after the French and Indian Wars, which brought them into British Canada. European, African, and Asian immigrants have come to America throughout its history, some of them voluntarily, some of them by coercion, and some of them under pressure from circumstances at home. But they've all adapted a single language, a single polity, and a single culture, although it's got lots of rich accretions from them all. Assimilation was sometimes heavy-handed, the Americanization policy during the First World War, for example. But more often it's been voluntary because of the obvious advantages of belonging to the English-speaking group. Most citizens, and particularly most immigrants' children, have wanted to be good English speakers because the advantages are so great and because it opens up a vast world of choice to you. If you stay in an ethnic subculture, such as has always existed in America, you're far, far more constrained in the kinds of things you can choose to do. And most immigrants appreciate and love the choices which America gives them. Attentiveness to multiculturalism in recent decades has also reminded all Americans of the diversity of the sources from which they came. And at its best, multiculturalism makes us alert to all those things. British institutions certainly had perhaps the most important bearing, both in the creation of the national culture and its language and many of its legal and political traditions. But on the other hand, the ideas, the cultures, the languages, even the foods of America have come from much of the rest of the world, with the immigrants bringing them in. Multiculturalism ought not to be taken to mean, I think, that all cultures are equally good. America is right, in my view, in taking the view that certain cultures and certain cultural activities are better than others, and that the nation has got a defensible set of principles and policies which are worthy of emulation by others. America is sometimes accused by its internal critics of cultural imperialism. Well, that may be true, but on the other hand, it perhaps ought not to be as shamefaced about them as it sometimes is. Its educational system has made it very, very successful at assimilating new groups of people. And again, it's far short of the ideal. I mentioned in the last lecture Alan Bloom's book, The Closing of the American Mind, which is a great lament for how American civilization is failing in its mission. But note that book was a great bestseller. The fact that tens of thousands of Americans bought it and worried over it was itself a kind of disproof of his hypothesis. If the American mind really had closed, as Bloom said, everyone would have ignored it and would have proved his point by ignoring it. In fact, there's intense concern for cultural, for learning and for sensitivity. America's got a very distinguished literary and artistic tradition, which is as lively and vibrant today as it's always been. In the early 19th century, it was dependent on British models. People like Walter Scott and Charles Dickens were the most famous novelists in America. But gradually, it's taken on and created a literary tradition of its own, with people like Ralph Waldo Emerson and Mark Twain and Walt Whitman. And then some of the very greatest novelists in the history of the world, people like Henry James and Scott Fitzgerald. There's arguments about who's the best and who's good. My own view is that the post-Second World War era has seen an astonishing flowering of brilliant American literary creativity, perhaps particularly in the work of Jewish novelists like Saul Bellow, Philip Roth, Norman Mailer, and Chaim Potok, who I've mentioned at various times in the course. Since at least 1950, possibly earlier, America's led the world in scientific research. Many of the great breakthroughs in physics and biology and astronomy were made at American institutions and with American funding. Aspiring scientists everywhere else in the world who want to become first-class scientists have to include at least a period of study, a postdoc, at an American university where the laboratory facilities are unparalleled elsewhere. And in America, there's a great commitment to education, the endowment of education. Generations of villains in America have sanitized their names by attaching that name to educational institutions. Just think of some of the great universities: Duke, Stanford, Carnegie Mellon, Rockefeller, Vanderbilt. These are the names of people who were bitterly hated in their day. But because they committed some of their fortunes to philanthropy and education, they're now places which are venerated. So turning the bad to something good. Well, it'd be possible to say far more on these general subjects, but constraints of time inhibit me. Wealth, freedom, democracy, and the capacity to include newcomers have all contributed to America's exceptional character. America's is a history full of imperfections, and it's the story of a nation constantly falling short of its ideals. But it's also got a very great deal to be proud of, especially when compared with the actual alternatives available in the world. And so now, on behalf of Alan Gelzo, who led you through the colonial days, and through the revolution, and through the early national period, and on behalf of Gary Gallagher, who explained the convulsions of the mid-19th century and the Civil War era, I'd like to close by thanking you all for devoting 42 hours to what, even so, can only be an introduction to the richness of American history.
We genuinely hope you've enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are available to order online on our website at www.teach12.com or call our customer service representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-832-2412. Thank you very much.